begin with a little bow. Welcome to the people that haven't been here before, and to the people who haven't been here before. I've been to the Longmont Meditation Group at the other location a few times, and I was remembering that the last time I was there, I was kind of waxing nostalgic about it, you know, even though I'd only been there once before that. But it did actually trigger in me a lot of memories about being in lovely little meditation centers all over the place, actually, and having a sense of the preciousness of the situation. So being here, I see that, you know, this is even better than that one. So I was trying to think of what would be interesting and appropriate to speak about to start our discussion this evening, and several things kind of popped into my mind, and I thought, well, actually, I don't know if we, you know, do you usually go around and say your names? So my name, we could go clockwise usually. My name is Barbara Smith, and I live in Boulder, and I've been a student of meditation, primarily the founder of Shambhala, Trungpa Rinpoche, since 1971.
My name's Tim Fisher, and I live in Firestone, and I've been coming to the group for a few years.
I'm Trudy Lyford, and I used to work with Barbara and a few other people in Boulder at the Shambhala different Shambhala training venues, and now I simply meditate. I find it very helpful.
I think you've been seen coordinating. Yeah, my spies tell me you're still afoot.
My name is Barbara Schwendler, and I've been with the Sangha for around 2010, about 6 years.
My name is Kristen. I'm fairly new to the group. I've been meditating with this group for about 6 months or so, I guess. So I'm enjoying it very much.
I'm Trudy Wayne, and I've been a member here for a couple of years.
I'm Eric Meyer, and I've been doing this for a while, not the 70s, but the 80s. Mm-hmm. And right at the moment, I'm the coordinator of this group, which means we get to schedule meetings.
Send and read lots of emails.
I'm Jean Russell, and this is my first visit here. Yeah.
You're
welcome. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'm Constance, and I started coming to this group at the end of January.
Richard and I have been coming for about 5 or 6 years here, and I'm taking the Enlightened Society Assembly in June.
Great.
And I'm George Ramsey. And I've been a student of meditation. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, gosh, that goes way back. I mean, to the 60s, you know, yoga-based meditation, and then I did TM for 2 weeks. And, but primarily, I've been a student of Trungpa Rinpoche in this tradition for 40 years. This is my 40th year anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary.
Yeah. And I live in Niwot.
I'm Bill Lyford, and I started this 28 years ago, a couple months ago, and Barbara Smith was the resident director of Shambhala Training at the time for all the Shambhala training I did.
That long ago, my goodness.
It was, yeah, 88.
Thank you, everyone. it's actually very, I don't know that people maybe have this opportunity that often. I think it is kind of a rare opportunity to have people who are brand new with people that are, you know, have been around as long, as really, like George, as long as it's been possible to have been, you know, a student of meditation in this culture together. And so I think it's very precious time to kind of reflect. I'm told by a friend of mine who's an astrologer that I think it might be maybe still Mercury in retrograde. Not that I know what that means, but what I'm told is that I think all traditions have something like this, where there is a time in the month or the year or in cycles where you actually reflect back. You reflect as opposed to starting all kinds of new projects necessarily, but there's a time when you use to see where you've come from, and there might be an element of that being chaotic on some level. So the idea that things are seemingly moving backwards as opposed to that you feel like you're moving forward, when actually the sense of being able to reflect is very profound. And in a way, I think that maybe other people could say what they think is the most important thing about meditation. Just in a word or two, you know, you could just sort of say it out in your own experience. What have you found to be the most important thing? Not necessarily the most pleasant, but the most important thing about meditation. Especially, you know, those of you who've been doing it a long time obviously have found it helpful.
Well,
unless you're just torturing yourself.
Getting to know me and be more accepting of me has been a big part of what meditation has helped me with.
Just, yeah, making
friends with myself.
As we say, making friends with yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. Anybody else?
Well, I mean that it's true that we have this basic wakefulness in us, and that can actually be brought out, that can be accessed and brought forth. So, I mean, that's an amazing thing.
It took me a while to realize I was not my thoughts.
And like some of the huge thoughts that you carry around for your whole life, you can not believe them. You can let them fall away. That's amazing. Mm.
As a newcomer to practicing meditation, I would say for me it's having gratitude for the present moment and not, you know, ruminating about the past and not wondering what's going to happen tomorrow and, you know, going over all the things that I have to do. It's just being able to be. I'm not very good at that, but I'm getting better at it, and it's a very good place to be.
Uh-huh. So, anything else?
I think for me, it will be letting go. I tend to be the kind of person that holds on to things.
Mm.
And that's okay if it's something really good, but... The things that I don't want, just let them go. Let go of thinking about them anyway.
Mm.
Unless I have to.
Yeah. Did you want to say that, Richard?
Well, I feel that I've learned a lot about myself, and I've done a lot of stupid things in my life. And it made me realize that they were stupid things. And I think it's been very helpful in helping me to realize that I'm not a bad person.
Just a stupid one, huh?
But it's you kind of a middle path.
Mm.
And it really is helpful on a spiritual path to be able to know that you're in control of that. And yet, if you try to control it, you really don't want to try to control it. You let it take its own course and you follow it. And it's a great experience every day.
Mm. Wow. Well, I think we've heard the main themes, don't you think? Is there anything else people could think of that? I mean, what we've been listening to are testimonials, I suppose. which we don't necessarily solicit them generally as testimonials, but the things that we like to talk about in terms of introducing people to meditation turn out to be actually the real reasons that you meditate over time, although they might not sound right philosophically to begin with. So what are we talking about in terms of the practice of meditation? And you know, as George pointed out, he did other kinds of meditation to begin with, than the simple shamatha sitting meditation practice that we do here now. And a lot of meditation practices do, and in these times, these things seem to cycle through society, you know, where there's, I don't know if people are aware that the spiritual movement in America began in, you know, the end of the 19th century with,
Edgar Cayce?
Mm. No, it was the Hindu teacher.
Oh, yes.
And he was a very wonderful person, and people really adored him. And then Yogananda came in, and people had the same kind of adoration for him. And it was very popular. It was very popular in Europe, the whole spiritual movement.
Vivekananda,
thank you.
Hi.
Yeah.
Go on.
You should look him up. He's quite, you could see on these people that they have a presence that's very attractive. And so these things in the culture have become very popular, and then actually there's always been a kind of backlash against them as well. And same thing in Europe, actually. So there's a popularity and then a backlash, and then popularity and a backlash. And so now we seem to be going through another wave of, you know, what mindfulness practice. And you know, you could, if you read through it, some of them seem to be making, you know, kind of promises and about states of mind that you can achieve through meditation. That in the Shambhala and the Buddhist tradition, we tend to say, well, really, maybe just settle down about that sort of thing, because the actual reason to meditate and to take it over the long haul, as people are looking at here, has more to do with getting in touch with yourself, and maybe you're not going to like that, especially in some cases, you know, and sometimes looking at your habitual patterns might not be all that originally acceptable to you. And then we begin to say, well, why do this? Well, then there's the theory to do it is that, as George pointed out, that we do have this wakefulness, this sanity, and this wisdom, and it is a kind of a leap of faith to sit with yourself, and very often it's out of hope, and very often it's out of desperation, because you know you don't actually feel like you have any other options but to sort of, as you say, let go. And so this is actually in the theory, and also in the 2,500-year-old history of the meditation as we do it, coming through the line of the Buddha, where the Buddha, as an example, went through in his own life the need to give up the fixations that he had and give up the pleasures of materialism, because as you point out, he realized that things are impermanent. You know, the sense of why do we want to live in the now? It's because, you know, things actually, not just that we need to let go of them, but they let go of us. So the sense that things are changing, and that quality of impermanence, is one of the basic tenets of the practice of meditation, is coming into direct contact with the laws of nature, you could say. And one of them is impermanence. And that could be, you know, something that we're happy about at some points, you know, this isn't going to last long. And then at other points, you know, we're desperately trying to hold on to something that we like. So you know, we employ the laws of impermanence, you know, to our advantage. But it doesn't actually work that way. Things will change nonetheless, you know, and very often they change for the better. So the Buddha, but nonetheless, the idea of change is very shaky for some people and causes discomfort. And that quality of unsettledness is another one of the tenets of looking at ourselves, which is that kind of discomfort or dukkha. It's a form of suffering. It's a true state of being, that our desires to hold on to things and make them solid makes us feel uncomfortable. It's not necessarily suffering in the sense of constantly being in torment and then wanting to have pleasure to get away from it, but the quality of fixating on our experience, whatever it is, it is actually called dukkha, or that kind of uncertainty is constantly with us, that kind of quality of uncertainty, where we're trying to fix things, and as you notice, things are impermanent, so therefore we're uncomfortable. And even the one who's perceiving, this is very disturbing for a lot of people as well, to realize that, or to actually have it suggested that even the perceiver of change is changing. So that's what is called the egoless, the state of that we don't have a permanent identity to hold on to, even to witness these things changing. You know, and sometimes we regard that as a pleasurable state, but nonetheless, we're sort of generally in a state of chaos about all of that. You know, that the more we try to fix on it, on something, the more we try to fix on our identity, the more the evidence is against us. So the suggestion in the meditation paradigm is that, well, actually, the very sense of having that quality of awake, as George pointed out, is in the moment, and that it's more fundamental, it's more primary, it's more unconditional, and it's good, it's sane. We call it basic goodness in the Shambhala tradition. And that it's more reliable. So you can let go, you can relax. And this becomes one's own actual path to do it in oneself. You know, you could struggle, we struggle with it theoretically. And maybe it's understandable, or maybe it's kind of something to hold up against the chaos theory. But those things are not actually in conflict in any case. But the sense that we could take a leap, we could make friends with ourself, is very intimate and personal journey, and sometimes it's regarded as the path is a lonely journey, because things that one of us might find as a huge relief to let go of, another person finds as a kind of a something to regret and to feel the loss of. So the one of the other tenets of meditation, you could say, is that fundamentally, what are the qualities of that basic goodness? Are that we do have a natural ability to feel empathy and compassion for other people. That's actually part of our nature as well. But we don't tend to access it very easily sometimes, because we're kind of hung up on ourselves. We're thinking about our own issues, whatever they are. That sometimes we would rather just hang up ourselves and hold on to an issue, just because we feel slightly less insecure. We feel more secure, that we'd actually rather suffer in our own private way than the familiar way. That's kind of what regarded as kind of like that, building an ego nest, or a kind of quality of a cocoon, that we'd rather stay cloistered in our own familiar kind of smell, because we generated it and we know it, and it's less scary, and we can complain quietly to ourselves about it and other people. But fundamentally, part of the suggestion here is, part of the reason it's kind of just a low-grade sort of fever that we keep ourselves in, is simply out of fear, and that it's not really necessary. So the sense of letting go, as you say, in the meditation practice, is that actually let go. Even in the moment, you let go, and then, sure, your habitual patterns will return. But they become the ideas that they become, and you can see from the people who are witnesses to this that they become less solid. They become more transparent. So as you go along, you begin to these sort of suggestions that you begin to see through your patterns and the qualities of wakefulness and friendliness that you, by simply doing this form of accommodation to yourself, makes you more accommodating to other people. You start to recognize that other people suffering is, might have a different author. It does have a different author, but there's only about 10 storylines, I'm told. My son who's a filmmaker, he says that supposedly in that world there's only 10 stories. You should look at this, Eric, when you're looking at movies and see, you can start to see how. I mean, there's in the tradition of meditation, all these things happen tracked in many different ways, and we do begin to be able to identify the patterns. So we can begin to identify how other people. Maybe it's really dumb. They should know better, but you could still see how the pattern has worked on them, and that maybe the subject and objects were different for you, but still the pattern of grasping and fixation is pretty much universal. So the notion of chaos is not necessarily, I was just thinking about chaos, interestingly enough, because it has nothing to do with May 5th, does it, particularly? What is May 5th? It's
Cinco de Mayo.
Cinco de Mayo. It's not a particularly connected to chaos, is it?
But it is in Europe, where they had major strikes, workers striking for little revolts in Europe on May 5th.
Oh, really? Okay, so yeah, there is a connection.
So,
this is also Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Oh, okay.
If you want to talk about chaos.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the reason I was thinking about chaos was when I was driving to come here, I was stopping at some place I usually stop at, and they weren't open, so I went somewhere else. And that was really nice. I really liked it. And then they messed up my order, but then they felt bad, so they gave me something free.
Oh.
So then I was sitting there waiting for my order, and I looked through a couple of books before I come to do these things, and I sort of just picked up the ones that matched in color, I suppose.
They do.
So I picked up The Heart of the Buddha, which is a collection of talks by Trungpa Rinpoche, and The Shambhala Principle by Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. So that's Trungpa Rinpoche's son, who now is the head of the organization, FYI, if you're interested in that. But so I picked up this book, and the Sakyong starts talking about chaos. Do you remember this?
Chaos is good news.
Yeah. Chaos is good news.
That might be the name of the chapter, right?
Chaos is good news is the name of the chapter.
Yeah.
So what the Mipam Rinpoche says is, I asked my father, if everything is basic goodness, why is life so confusing? It seemed to me that the world was becoming ever more crowded, speedy, anxious, and intense. People were acting less compassionate, more aggressive, and more prideful. Society seemed painful, competitive, and confused. What if we all become so isolated and scared that we forget to take care of one another? Knowing that this was in my heart, my father said that pain comes from people and society not recognizing their own wakeful potential. When people are not being genuine to themselves, they experience suffering. Then he said something that I think he meant to be consoling, but the statement puzzled me. Chaos is good news. What could possibly be good about chaos, I replied. My father went on to explain that he was referring to chaos in the way that the Greeks had used the word to indicate a wide open expanse. Chaos is the great space of emptiness that occurs before Genesis. It is the openness where things fall apart and new creations arise. When you nearly crush your car or slip and nearly fall, your conceptual mind loses its grip and you are left in an open space. This space provides an opportunity to reconnect with what lies under the chaos and negativity, inherent awakened nature. So that's, I find, a challenging statement, and I don't feel like I feel like it kind of deserves not to be explained away on some level. But I do think that it's definitely worth keeping in mind, because when I ask myself the question, what is the most important thing about meditation? I think that my response is very similar to everything everybody said, but the term accommodation comes to mind for me as well, and that the idea of accommodating the chaos to begin with is so important in the meditation. You know, it's so important to accommodate the sense of chaos and uncertainty. Because it's really the only way, I think, that we can then accommodate it around us and then accommodate it in the bigger world. And the world is so begging for people to be accommodating, right? I mean, even in the most simple exchanges that that we have, it seems like people are so on edge, of so afraid of... I think it's because of the speed, in these times, that if you make a mistake, that, things are kind of dire, Literally, you could have a car accident, or if you push the wrong button on the computer. My husband did that like 6 months ago, and he's still trying to straighten out like a whole insurance thing. You just 1 second, push the wrong button, and there you go. So. It's not totally unwarranted that people are slightly panicky. So the idea here, I think, is that how can we actually take that to make something more, take the actual panic and the chaos and make accommodation out of it in a way, to take the situation that is presenting in our lives as an opportunity, so to speak. There's another story that comes to mind around this. People may be familiar with this. Has anybody listened to Alan Watts? Mm-hmm. He tells this story. I don't know if I've just heard him tell. I've heard the same talk more than once, or if he tells it more than once. But I think it's a Taoist-based story about a farmer in the village who's. You may have heard it. The farmer in the village who's one of his horses runs away. So his neighbors all come and say, "Oh, that's really sad." And he said, "Well, maybe, And the next day, the horse comes back bringing a few wild horses with. And so the neighbors all come and say, "Well, that's really great, And he says, "Maybe." So the next day, his son is... breaking, as they say, taming one of the wild horses, and falls off and breaks his leg. And so the neighbors all come and say, "That's really too bad." And he says, "Maybe." And the next day, the conscription officers come, and they would have drafted the boy, but since he had a broken leg, they had to leave. And so the neighbors all came and say, "Well, that's great." And he said, "Maybe." I suppose you could make up more and keep going that way. if we're fixating on good and bad, circumstances, we're always kind of closing in on our situation. So how do we actually accommodate is like the only way that I know of, and that's what's said in this tradition as well, to accommodate whatever arises is through the practice of meditation and the accommodation that we give to ourselves in that. So then maybe people could say, what is the most difficult thing about meditation over their experience?
Mm.
I think it's still getting to the cushion on a regular basis for me.
But I bet you do other things pretty...
I like
you're such a reliable person. So.
I like to think that some of the other things that I do are a sort of practice.
Oh, okay. Right, not just you're not just watching TV, I don't think.
No. Well, we have watched a lot more since my mother moved in with us. We watched a lot of old movies.
Ah. But yes, okay, so just the so would you say it's the is the difficulty the because once you get there it's probably not.
No, once you get there, it's like coming home.
Right.
Somehow.
But is it like making a schedule or keeping to a schedule that's difficult?
It's keeping to the schedule that's difficult. And right now, or in the last several months, it's been making the schedule because I've been living according to my energy level a lot. And when I have energy, I don't necessarily go sit down with it.
You lie down. Well, you haven't been well, so that does.
That's different.
Yeah. That's a different. You have to accommodate that.
But I could say maybe.
Yeah.
About all of that because it was so traumatic to get sick. But then what I discovered is, all the space around being ill, that I don't experience normally in my regular life, and it somehow was an opening of sorts. For me, and I intend to live my life a little differently.
People often say that, right?
I know, yeah. And I'm already starting to do the same old things.
Okay, but then what else is there? Do other people have? What are the issues about the difficulties of meditation?
Well, sometimes it makes things too clear. I mean, it's like, you know, you refine your sensitivity through practice, and you become sensitive to all kinds of things that you could just brush off before or push aside. They're more in your face. And for me, I'm more aware of when I'm kidding myself about something. I think I'm more aware of that. So it's hard. It becomes, life can be more challenging because of that greater openness, but you're also open to more of the subtle beauty of things. Mm-hmm. Can I tell a little story?
Yeah, please.
I mean, I was at Kinko's FedEx over here earlier in the week, and I was waiting to be waited on, and there was this little kid who was about this tall. I don't know how old that is, maybe
pretty young.
Really little. Yeah. But walking, and he wasn't talking or anything, but and there were some stuffed animals on a shelf for sale. And of course, they put them right at eye level with these kids, you know, that good marketing. But he went over and he picked one up and he looked at it. And then he put it back. And then he picked up this other one and he looked at it and he went... and he kissed it. And I mean, it was so touching. I mean, it just kind of like... It was heartbreakingly beautiful. It's like this sweet little innocent kid, you know. And he's seeing this thing, and he just felt so fond of it that he just gave it this little kiss. Anyway, so, I mean, those kinds of moments that you get opened up to are so...
It's true.
You know, you have to take the bitter with the sweet when you do this practice. It's all going to come at you, you know. But I guess... You know, the challenge is to just keep going with your experience, and things change into something else.
For me, it's getting my thought processes to be quiet, quieting my mind. That's really hard for me.
Well, you're touching on an important point, really, because that's one of the harder things to really learn is that you don't have to do that. You know, you want to do that, but it's not really necessary. So the idea is that it seems like your thoughts have sped up actually when you start to sit, but the presentation is is that you're noticing them. Like George is saying, you're noticing it. So the idea isn't that you need to actually slow it down or to even desire it to slow down. Because the problem we tend to have with the thinking process is that we listen to it a little too closely, you know. So it's not the thinking that's really disturbing our meditation, it's our about it. So when we begin to sort of feel like really the mind is the ocean and thinking is the waves, and that they're not separate, it's just mind waves. That's a term that Suzuki Roshi used to use, with mind waves. You know, so thinking is not actually disturbing our it's just in the room, kind of. And literally, that's one of the reasons we sit with our eyes open, is that, you know, the things in the room, it could be windy, or it could be, like we were sitting here and somebody's car went off. That's like your thoughts, right? So by the time for me, by the time I settled on that it wasn't really disturbing my meditation, you know, it stopped. That's kind of like symbolic in a certain way, you know. That is not really the thinking that's a trouble to the meditation. It's the imbalance that the weight that we give it. So I would say that's pretty classic obstacle in terms of sitting meditation is being, you know, giving thoughts that kind of brick, you know, heavy brick. Because the idea as you go along, they become more like balloons. So one thing that is recommended is you just look at them, you know, and see that the idea is to look at where they originate, where they dwell, and where they disappear to as part of the practice. So you know, as a thought arises, you see it as having like a head. So you don't cut it off at the head. You just let it kind of be there, and then you see the torso of it, and then you see the feet, and then you label it thinking at that. You can label it thinking at that point, and by just simply allowing it, it's kind of like any ghost, supposedly, you know, that if you say, okay, I get you, you're there, you know, so what? That's the idea, that it just, it, you know, there's a bigger space than the thoughts demand you. They can be in the room just like, you know, everybody else. So yeah, it's a big one, is dealing with thoughts in meditation, definitely. Yeah, so the idea is they just become more transparent, not necessarily go away. But I would say that's certainly a big one. What about physical pain? Does anybody have any issues with that? Sitting?
I have chronic pain issues, so sometimes it's...
Anyway, you mean outside of the... Okay, so if you know that, that's also a good thing to keep in mind about a meditation is sometimes people have pain when they sit down, and then as soon as they get up, it's gone. That's maybe something else, maybe not a physical problem. But if you know you have physical pain, you know, anyway, then you need to work with somebody maybe who could help you find the right height cushion or, you know, et cetera, if you haven't done that yet. But that's a really good, that's important thing that Trungpa Rinpoche was very concerned that people have, you know, a good experience, not because it's, you know, it's hard enough to be alone with yourself, right? Maybe, but so you have a good setup so that you're... That's why he came up with these gamdans. He said that you can sit comfortably till you're 75, you know.
Oh, we're getting close.
but, you know, now that you know how, you probably can't pass that anyway. But you should be able to sit, you know, straight up and comfortably with your knees, you know, your knees below your hip and all, you know, all the general rules. But if you have chronic pain, then definitely don't torture yourself. But does anybody else have pain apart from the usual?
I sat for, I don't even know how many years. It was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Trudy and I did a program up at Shambhala Mountain Center with David Rome and Hope Martin.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And she helped me immensely. Until then, I always had pain when I was sitting.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
What did she do that helped? What was it?
Well, it was minuscule. Like I'd be sitting and she'd straighten me out.
She made actual minor adjustments.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Whispering in your ear and...
Yeah.
Well, it's just, yeah, so don't sit in chronic pain is the point. Right, if you can't find somebody like that, somebody else might be able to help you. Just look in a mirror, you know, or look at you sideways. See, because people don't often realize they're doing this or this, you know. Yeah. Like, I don't mind, my neck hurts whenever I sit, you know. They're like,
it is true, though. I mean, because we sit the way we normally sit, and often we normally sit straight.
If somebody just does this much, you might not realize that you're your ribs are collapsing.
Yeah.
What else?
It's not a difficulty. It was a realization I had at one point. Is sort of like riding a bicycle in the sense that once you start meditating, you always know how to do it, and you notice things that you didn't used to notice, and you can't stop. You can't go back to being totally...
That's what George was saying, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like becoming a vampire or something.
It's an acquired taste.
Yeah, you can't go back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's important. It is an acquired taste.
He was an acharya in the Shambhala, one of the main teachers. I staff retreats with her, and she often would talk about this, what we're doing here. I mean, normal people don't do this. I mean, it's not, I'm not saying none of us are normal in here, but it's not a natural tendency to want to lean into what's difficult or put yourself in a position where you have to deal with your boredom or your restlessness or your whatever it is. I mean, it's... But we all here, we intuitively know there's some reason to do that. There's some benefit to doing this, to going against the grain. But she said it's an acquired taste. And I thought that was so appropriate. It is an acquired taste. And once you've been doing it, you sit down and you know, I'm going to feel uncomfortable at times, and I'm going to feel hot when I want to be cool, and I'm going to be cool when I want to be hot, and I'm going to be angry when I want to be peaceful. But those things happen, and because it's an acquired taste, you go, oh, I know, I've not been here before. You go through this, and this is what happens. And,
Sounds like accommodation.
Exactly.
Again, right?
Yeah. It is. Learning to accommodate whatever is.
And you wear things out.
Yeah.
Well, that I've heard that. I've heard about that.
Yeah.
Have you noticed the older you get, you don't wear your clothes out quite? I'd like to buy some new clothes, but they don't wear out anymore. Some things do wear out.
Yes, they do.
Well, and I think that's the issue about doing it regularly that comes up so often is... You know, it doesn't have to be for a long time, but that's part of developing that taste for it, is just to do it and do it and do it, even if it's only a few minutes at a time. And then you begin to know when you sit down on your cushion, something immediately sort of says, oh, I'm sitting now, and you can go forward.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually, you know, yeah, I mean, it might just be, you might go through, I guess this is one of the things I have found difficult over time, is that you might not feel like you're advancing or even having realizations or even thinking a lot, you know. but then you do notice that there is kind of something that you miss if you don't do it, because in a way, what the contrast is that you don't quite feel the third dimension of your perceptions the way you do when you're more sensitive in terms of sitting. So you might be just like noticing that's one of the things I think what I hear from what George said is that you're more sensitive to other people, and maybe that's not necessarily pleasurable, you know, to see their suffering or even their sweetness.
Yeah, John Rockwell said, he said it's like the fuzz on your teeth when you don't brush.
And yeah.
You begin to notice that things aren't quite right.
Yeah, you might not necessarily notice how great it is when you do it, but you kind of notice
maybe
that.
You don't.
Yeah. So I think the recommendation is really just simply to, like Trudy's saying, you have a regular schedule and you sit in it, and that you stop watching whether, oh, was that a good session? Did I achieve something there? You know, like you don't really think about how clean your teeth feel every time you brush them, right? Although sometimes you do, I suppose.
What you said about sitting, and sometimes it feels wonderful and sometimes it feels like a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
And what you said earlier about looking back, retrospective, is I think that's always helpful. That, you know, if you look back, you know, well, 6 months ago or a year ago, the meditation hasn't been anything spectacular, but something has changed, you know, and that's helpful, I think.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you notice that, like, if you have a Dharma book you like to read, you know, or you read the first, you go back and read the first book you ever read on meditation and you didn't understand it, and then, you know, 20 years later, 40 years later, you think, well, I'm still just as confused as I was when I read that. But then you go and read it and think, well, I get this perfectly. This is totally clear. But your experience might still be that you're not solid in some kind of clear way, but you're more open. So it isn't necessarily that you see, you know, these great markers on the path, but sometimes, you know, reflection is good, I think, is the point, because you do see that you are on a path, you're on a journey. And the little things are kind of, small things might be what make you appreciate that. Eric and I were talking about looking at movies, you know, and the different takes on different books throughout.
Mm-hmm. Like a particular book, and they'll make a movie of it in the 1930s, and then again in the 1970s,
right.
And then again, like, last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really interesting to watch. And,
yeah, like, what is, yeah, like, the whole the societal view or Hollywood's view, like, an entity, mm-hmm. and the book hasn't actually changed, but the take on it changes. And
So your life is that way too. I mean, you know, that your what you were engaged with when you were 20, you know, seems very different than what it is now. But in a way, it isn't. Also, so there is something.
Right.
Well, you also think you're the same person you were when you were 20, but no one else would say that about you.
Yeah, until you look in the mirror,
yeah.
You feel like the same person.
Yeah.
Movies
are great for that for me. I mean, because I think, oh, I haven't seen that movie yet. I love that movie so much. That was my favorite movie. And you watch it, it's like, wow, this is terrible.
Yeah.
What kind of person was I to like that?
Yeah. Right.
The opposite happens, too.
Yeah. And you think you're the same person, right?
The movie hasn't changed,
like, yes.
That's one of the things I have learned to appreciate watching a lot of the older films with my mom, is that there's actually time within the film to kind of get the story and experience it, where a lot of movies are so fast and speedy today that I never quite know what's happened because it's gone so fast.
No, it's true. But that's, I think, what I was—I meant by the whole, the sense of speed and the in this culture now. I think it's probably everywhere too, right?
Yeah, they said that they were giving up siesta time in Spain.
Right, I heard that on the radio.
Oh,
that is too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because they have things that they should be doing to. you know, to improve the economy.
Well, also, it was like too long to go home and come back because of the traffic.
Yeah.
Wow. That's sad.
Or long lunches and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I'll take the siestas for them.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that comes along with age, is actually you can go back to having your nap.
I still fight it.
Okay, well.
It's probably time.
Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. My
pleasure.
What a good discussion. Good, something to reflect on.
Yeah,
actually.
It's the reflection time.
So
contemplation.
Let's see. I have a little